This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, Lynn Malcolm with you on All in the Mind. Today, from our series of highlight programs from my years as host on All in the Mind, we bring you a program from 2019, which I'm sure will resonate with you now. We look at anxiety and how to manage it. Have you encountered the worry bully?
The worry bully is, everyone has it. It's this thing inside your head that keeps on telling you worries and worries and worries, and the more you listen to it, the stronger it gets.
I used to procrastinate a lot about things, which is possibly the worst thing that you can do for your worries, because you're just putting off those worrying things and then they build up and build up and build up. I think I'm a bit of a hard marker on myself, and I was really surprised with how much my mental state was affecting me physically.
30-year-old Peter Leipnik, and before him was 10-year-old Willow Freer. For both of them, their worries became overwhelming, and so they sought professional help.
We all experience anxiety to some degree because it's part of our primitive survival mechanisms in response to threat in our environment. So our brain responds, the amygdala hijacks our brain and triggers the fight or flight reaction, which is a physiological reaction to set our body up to fight or to run away from danger. That response occurs with perceived threat as well.
Dr. Jodie Lowinger is a psychologist and CEO of the Sydney Anxiety Clinic.
Anxiety in a normal context for most human beings, for all human beings, gets triggered in response to trying to survive against danger. Where it turns from anxiety into an anxiety disorder is if this threat response occurs to a level that it's providing prolonged fear, suffering and avoidance in a person's life.
It's estimated that 25% of the population develop clinical anxiety, and it's recently become more common in children and adolescents. Jodie Lowinger suggests that one of the factors leading to increasing anxiety in young people is the technologically driven environment we now live in.
Kids are experiencing anxiety that is, certainly in Western society, largely around some of this digital technology that is overwhelming now. And everybody presenting their airbrushed selves on digital technology or in social media, the sense of compare and despair or fear of not being good enough or fear of missing out, not getting invited to the parties. So there's one element of the impact of digital technology which perhaps there's more recognition of, which is around cyberbullying. Then there's the fear of failure or fear of not being good enough or fear of missing out. Then there's the impact that it has on our children getting the exercise that they need, getting the fresh air that they would have otherwise done prior to digital technology. And it's not just our children, it's us as well. So the impact of this is its connection, but its disconnection. We are tribal creatures. We crave connection, and the technologically driven world that we have is creating a false sense of connection, but it's not the connection that we truly deeply need. It's not the connection that stimulates dopamine and oxytocin and endorphins from hugs and touch and love and eye contact and the impact that it has on sleep as well. This is something that's frazzling our younger generations.
Jodie Lowinger.
Hi, I'm Miriam Heatherich. I am the mother of gorgeous Willow, and Willow has made some great progress over the last few years with her anxiety.
My name is Willow Freer. I'm 10 years old and I'm in year 5.
Willow first started feeling anxious after she and her family moved to Australia from Singapore, and she started in a new school.
I was scared of making friendships with new people. I was scared that I was going to embarrass myself. I was worried that people would make a lot of fun of me and I'd never be able to get friends at that school. And I would get bad results because I was so focused on friendships.
Did you experience any bullying?
Yes, I actually did. Some of the girls, they tried to get away from me and they said, why don't you go and get your lunch? And then when I came back, they weren't there anymore.
How'd that make you feel?
That made me feel really sad. And so I'd usually sit by myself. And that was when I found my first friend.
So when you were feeling worried and anxious, what did you feel in your body?
I felt really tense, and my palms, they would sweat a lot when I was writing stuff and thinking about it, when I was doing work in classroom and stuff. And my brain was all foggy.
Willow eventually told her mother that the kids were teasing her. Then her teacher asked the girls to stop being mean.
And they didn't do it again. Yeah.
That's nice.
They stopped doing it to me.
Did your anxious feelings just stop then?
No, they kept on going. I kept on feeling anxious about stuff. I kept on feeling anxious that maybe it happened again.
And what other things would you be worried about besides friendships?
I'd be worried about my grades and if I was doing okay or not, because I was getting a lot of C's and just C's, no B's, no A's then. So I got really worried about that. I also got really worried about how I slept, because I didn't sleep very well then. And I got really worried that maybe if I didn't sleep very well, I wouldn't do very well at school, and yeah.
And did you find that the more you worried, the more you worried? Did it just...
Yeah, I just kept on going and going and going. Dr. Jodie explained to me it's called the snowball thing, because when a snowball keeps rolling down the hill, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what she explained to me.
Miriam, tell me about what it was like when you first noticed that Willow was really anxious.
In retrospect, even as a baby, she was highly anxious, and anxiety is very prevalent on my side of the family. So if you have an anxious mum and an anxious child, it's definitely a recipe for extreme stress. So when we moved back to Australia after 5 years in Singapore, I underestimated how impactful those changes would be. New house, new school, new friends, new weather, and I was in my own world of stress and pain, and I just noticed that Willow was not going to sleep. And at that point, at 7.5 years old, she was up till 10 and 11 some nights, although we would get her into bed at 7:30. I felt completely helpless, actually. Like, had access to no tools to help a 7.5-year-old. And that, as a mum, it's so challenging. I'm sure I can appeal to all mums. If you can't help your child, you feel useless yourself. So then it just compounds the problem.
Willow's mum, Miriam. Jodie Lowinger often sees a family history of anxiety in the clients she treats.
I would be rare to find an individual who doesn't have some semblance of family history, unless it was, of course, a situation where there has been a particular trauma in a person's life, which can be a contributing factor. So we have got the influence of biology as well as environment contributing. And where there is influence of biology, we would have temperamental differences that would feed into that. Certain individuals with a particular kind of anxious temperament might be more inclined to perceive threat in their environment, and perhaps a more sensitized amygdala that would be more easily triggered into that fight or flight reaction. Another aspect of anxiety that I tend to see quite frequently in the clients I work with is this double-edged sword. On the one hand, really commonly, I would find that individuals have this deeper sense of empathy and a beautiful analytical mind. So deep thinkers, deep feelers. And so when we have a deeper sense of empathy, we're more likely to be aware of emotions in other people. So there's this kindness and compassion that can play out in individuals who experience anxiety more commonly. So what we do is we recognize those inherent strengths, the analytical mind and the compassion and kindness and empathy, and we stand up to the challenges that might go along with anxiety as well.
So what is that cycle that occurs in the brain which leads to a problem with anxiety?
So when I'm working with my clients, we think about it in terms of our perception, then triggering a message that goes to our amygdala, which then sets ourselves up to fight or to run away from a threat. So we get this surge of adrenaline and cortisol through our bloodstream that primes our body to be able to protect itself. And that physiological reaction is what we experience as anxiety.
It's about the perceived threat, isn't it? Perception is very important in this.
Perception is certainly important, because it's how we respond to a situation. We can allow fear to get in the way and perceive it in a threatening way, or we can reframe that situation and perceive it in a non-threatening way. And where perception is critical, there's power in that, because perception is something that we can do something about, and we can change our response to a particular situation and quieten that anxiety reaction.
Dr. Jody Lowinger. You're with All in the Mind on RN. I'm Lynn Malcolm. And today we're discussing what happens when our worries become overwhelming. Around a quarter of us develop clinical anxiety, which severely impacts our quality of life and well-being.
I wasn't quite feeling myself, feeling a bit lethargic, even a bit giddy, a bit dizzy, just really unenergized, like almost as if I was getting a bit sick. I went to my GP and he said, I think you should go speak to someone. I think you're overly anxious, overly worked up, probably a bit stressed out with what's going on. I didn't really know where it was going to go, because I didn't realise that a lot of the physical things that I was feeling were actually connected to my mental state.
Peter Leipnik is 30 years old and ended up seeking help for his anxiety.
After speaking to a professional, you don't really realise some of the underlying things and what they're actually doing to you. I used to procrastinate a lot about things, which is possibly the worst thing that you can do for your worries, because you're just putting off those worrying things and then they build up and build up and build up. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And did you have feelings that what you were going to do wasn't good enough or wasn't going to come up to scratch?
Yeah, I think I'm a bit of a hard marker on myself, so sometimes that's the case. I guess we've all got a bit of a fear of making the wrong decision, but when you break it down and you actually just make that decision and commit to it, the worst thing that can happen is really not that bad.
When you were in this anxious state, how was it affecting your working life?
I wasn't really myself. I'm usually pretty outgoing, you know, very, very positive. And I think when I was a bit anxious like that, I was overthinking things. I wasn't confident in myself. I wasn't that happy.
Are you aware of other people sort of in your age bracket that experience anxiety?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's a huge range of people. It really frustrates me quite a bit that I know friends, very close friends, in fact, that have got similar or the same issues that I do, and they don't do anything about it. I don't know if there's that stigma of getting help for mental health and things like that. These people, they'll go to the gym, they'll go for runs, they'll go for bike rides, everything physical, but not looking after the mental side of things. And for me, I'm really open about speaking about it, because there's no reason why you shouldn't look after your mental health. I mean, that's half the battle, right? Mm. Yeah.
And it seems that men seem to have more of an issue with speaking about it and admitting it than women do. Do you think that's the case?
I think that's the case. I mean, emotionally, we're a bit disconnected. I'm personally not that good at speaking about emotions, but I'm getting better at it because I see the advantages of it. And once it's out, you feel a lot better. I guess comparing yourself is a really bad way of running your own life, and that kind of leads into social media, I think, quite a bit, especially people, you know, circa my age. They see these things being portrayed on Instagram and Facebook and people putting up success stories, and they compare themselves. I think it's just important that, you know, you do you.
Are there any other aspects of this digital age that we live in that you think makes it a bit more difficult to deal with anxiety or feeds into it?
Yeah, I mean, speaking from experience, I'm in the service industry. Having my phone on me 24/7, it sometimes gives me anxiety. I feel like to give the best service, I always need to be on the phone. I need to be replying to emails, texts, phone calls. The quicker that I can do that, the better service I provide. That's what's in my head. In reality, it's not good for me mentally, because not that I wait by the phone, but like I said, I'm a hard marker on myself, and it comes back to me being on the phone all the time, yeah, instead of being present, so to speak.
Peter Leipnik. Jody Lowinger explains there are many types of anxiety, but underpinning most anxiety is a fear of uncertainty.
Commonly in contemporary society, it might be fear of being judged negatively or the perception about what somebody else is thinking of us. So it might be fear of making a mistake. So that's performance anxiety. So the fear of being judged negatively and fear of making a mistake, they're subsets of social anxiety. and one would be more around interpersonal situations and the other would be more around performance-related situations. Other areas where we have uncertainty is in health. What if this symptom or this sensation means that something bad is happening? So that might be when it tips into something that potentially is more like an OCD type presentation. But the core fear in these sorts of things is grappling with uncertainty and trying to get certainty when there isn't any certainty. And perfectionism and all of this sort of stuff is trying to get certainty.
Jodie Lowinger explains that people often respond to their anxious feelings with what she calls safety behaviours.
So safety behaviours would be fear-driven behaviours to try and quell that anxiety reaction. So we might conceptualise safety behaviours as things like mind reading, which is trying to work out what somebody else is thinking about us. It might be trying to avoid or escape from a situation. So that's more of a physical behavioral reaction. Procrastination is another avoidance type. But then there are other ways that we deal with these unpleasant emotions, and that might be trying to numb the emotions, perhaps looking at drugs and alcohol to try and numb these emotions, or self-harm is a way of numbing some of these challenging emotions. And very sadly, we have a horrendous prevalence of suicide in society now, again, in an attempt to get rid of difficult emotions.
Psychologist Jodie Lowinger says that anxiety is a highly treatable condition, but if we leave it unchecked, it can escalate over time. 10-year-old Willow has been treated at the Sydney Anxiety Clinic by Jodie Lowinger. Here's what Willow learnt about how to manage her anxiety.
The first strategy, I think, was put the book on the shelf because it's the same old book that you read, like the same old story, the same old worries. I put the book back on the shelf. That was the first strategy she taught me, I'm pretty sure. And also, she taught me how to do breathing, like breathe in, breathe out when you feel stressed or something. Breathe in the air, breathe out the fog. Because when your brain's so foggy, you can't focus that well. And so I'd be able to focus. And I did pretty well in my exams because of that. There's this other strategy she taught me about, like fight or flight, I'm pretty sure it's called. And so she told me that if you fly from something, it always follow you. And so that you've actually got to stand still. And she also taught me about the worry bully. The worry bully is, everyone has it. It's this thing inside your head that keeps on telling you worries and worries and worries. And the more you listen to it, the stronger it gets. And she told me that the worry bully isn't a friend or an enemy. It's just somebody who's there and you can't get rid of him or her. She gave me pens and colouring and stuff in arts and crafts, and we drew our worry bully on the paper bag. I kept on looking at the paper bag, and I put my worries in the paper bag as if like putting the book back on the shelf, putting the worries back in the worry bully.
Jodie Lowinger uses a compilation of evidence-based strategies to treat anxiety. It's called Mind Strength Therapy.
I use a lot of principles from narrative therapy, which is what's called externalizing the worry. It's almost personifying worry. It's like a story that worry tells us that's just thoughts in our head that we don't necessarily need to give the power that we typically give to worry. So we stand up to worry. We replace worry with more practical alternatives such as problem solving and action planning. We look at what's in our control and what's out of our control. There's a large toolkit of mind strength strategies that help to stand up to those fear-driven thoughts and those fear-driven behaviours. And then together we look towards helping a person move forward in a values-driven direction. It's what do we want to be pulled towards that gives us a sense of fulfillment. And providing an alternative pathway is a wonderful step to help people to feel empowered that there are alternatives that help them. And allow a person to learn that worry was telling them that something bad was going to happen. But when an individual feels empowered to approach rather than avoid, they allow themselves to build up a body of evidence to demonstrate that worry was wrong, that they were okay.
Peter Leipnik also sought help from Dr. Jodie Lowinger. One of the first things she got him to do was to keep a worry diary.
I ended up just writing it on my phone in the notes section, where any worrying thought that will come into your head, whether it's big or small, write it in the worry diary. So, for example, worried about being late to an appointment or worried about the outcome of a meeting. You put that in there before, and then the idea is that you look at it at the end of the day or the end of the week consistently. And when you look through it, you realize that none of those things actually eventuated to be as bad as you thought they would be, or they were just completely irrelevant. So I guess it comes back to you're trying to train your brain to get rid of those worrying thoughts, which can be quite difficult.
Were you able to take that insight into the next time you might have worried about something beforehand?
Yeah, definitely. So I look at my worry diary right now, write things in, and I scroll through the most recent ones and I think, why was that even in there? And I laugh at myself. And sometimes I'm about to write something and then I stop. I'm like, what am I doing this for? It's not even a worrying thought. So I guess you train your brain to forget those thoughts, yeah.
Peter Leipnik also benefited from considering his personal value system.
There was an instance recently in a professional work sense where I was feeling quite worked up and hard done by, and the underlying issue where I didn't feel quite right and where I got personally worked up was a misalignment of inner values. So basically my inner values and morals and ethics didn't align with the person that I was doing business with, and that derailed me a little bit. So I didn't get treated the way that I would generally treat someone, and that's what ended up in the wrong situation. So I guess it was one of those things where I kind of knew that before speaking to Jodie, but then speaking to her about it kind of uncovered it and explained to me why I was feeling like that.
And so what could you do about that misalignment of values?
I guess there were certain things that I could have done, but it's just accepting that not everyone will have the same beliefs and values as yourself, and that's just life.
It's about noticing it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think going into different situations, I don't want to have my guard up in those situations, but maybe tread more carefully next time.
So how are you feeling now compared to how you were before you sought help?
So it goes up and down, consistently better. And I think it's just building on it. You know, I try and see Jodie at least 10 times a year. I think that really helps. You got to stay on top of it. Sometimes when I feel really good, I feel like I don't need to see her, but it's one of those things where you need continually working on.
Peter Leipnik, who now shares some of the anxiety management strategies he's learnt with his colleagues in the workplace. Jodie Lowinger is in favour of all evidence-based strategies to treat anxiety, including medication where appropriate.
First and foremost is I would always want to ensure protection of harm of my clients, to make sure that if there is a risk of harm, that I would want to have a psychiatrist or certainly a GP, a medical doctor involved in the care, to get their wisdom alongside recommendations from a medication perspective. Sometimes if there is a more extreme presentation, it might be that the anxiety is so extreme that it's really making it very hard for an individual to engage in some of the clinical psychological strategies. But having said that, there is power behind these strategies. They make such a difference, and I can talk from experience. The bottom line is for people to feel encouraged to seek out the help they need and to not suffer in silence. Whether it's medication or psychological intervention, it doesn't matter. It's just recognizing and having the courage to say, I need help here, and allowing themselves to acknowledge that it is not a weakness. Anxiety is not a weakness. It's nothing to feel ashamed of. It is such a prevalent part of our human condition. And that statistic around 25%, and that's anxiety to a clinical level. Then there's the rest of us who all experience anxiety. There's a concept that I love to refer to, and it's called distress tolerance. Distress tolerance is one that I think can help so many people, and it's the key message to recognize that it's not weak to feel. the human beings who we are, we have emotions and it's part of who we are. And it doesn't mean that any shame needs to go alongside those emotions. When we feel that we're weak because we feel, then we push our feelings under the carpet and then we are more quick to choose drugs and alcohol, or we're more quick to for an individual to take one's life because they feel like they're not good enough for experiencing some of these difficult emotions. That's distress intolerance. And we are still raised with these messages, particularly the men in our society, but certainly the women as well, that we have to be stoic, we have to cope. But the world is a complex world filled with stressors that our body wasn't necessarily designed to experience. So naturally, we're going to have some emotional consequences to this. Distress tolerance is an empowering concept that says it is okay to feel. It's not about having those challenging experiences. It's about creating space to choose how you respond to those feelings, to engage in helpful strategies, help-seeking strategies, and feel proud of yourselves for that rather than ashamed of yourselves for that.
Dr. Jody Loewinger, CEO of the Sydney Anxiety Clinic and of Mind Strength Consulting, which works with organisations and schools developing well-being, resilience and performance programs. So how are you feeling now?
I feel way better about everything now. I don't really care what people think of me. I've got way more friends that I'm trying to make friendships. My grades are going up, that I'm breathing out the fog. And all my family stuff, I just think I can't do anything about it, so everything is fine.
And Willow's mum, Miriam, also sees the improvement in her daughter and, in fact, the whole family.
It's the mechanics for Willow and also for myself. So it's not like it can be controlled. It can be managed. And the more you observe yourself going, wow, that really upset me, for example, so mindfulness, which is one of Dr. Jody's techniques, when you are able to observe that in yourself and in your child, you can carry them through that situation.
So what are you most looking forward to now in your life?
I'm looking forward to camp, which is in a few days' time. We're going to Bathurst. I'm looking forward to getting our new snake.
Oh, snake. You're not frightened of that?
No, we've actually had one, but she died, so yeah.
That would make a lot of people very anxious, a snake.
Yeah, it's my sister. She loves snakes and animals, and we lived in Singapore, a lot of snakes and animals like that, especially cobras. Anyway, so yeah, I'm also excited to my next Dr. Jody appointment.
Because, why are you excited about that?
Because at camp, sometimes I can feel really homesick and I'd like her to help me, because in year six, we're going to Canberra and that's all going to be a long time. So I want her to help me with my homesickness.
Anything you'd like to add?
I love Dr. Jody. She's been a very good help in my life. Yeah.
Thanks to Willow Freer, her mum Miriam Hetheridge, and also to Peter Leipnick for sharing their experiences with us today. If anything you've heard in this program has caused you concern, you can call for support on Lifeline on 131114. And head to the All in the Mind website for more helpful links. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Isabella Tropiano. I'm Lynn Malcolm. It's great to have your company. Till next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.